Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Morning. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our service this morning.
Just talking.
Morning, everyone. Welcome. Oh, well, it's good to be here. And good to be standing on solid ground, hoping that all's been put back correctly, or so I may just descend at some point. It was great to have the baptisms last week. And if anyone came to the baptism and thought, oh, well, I'd like to be baptised maybe, or what's that all about, do come and chat to me. And we're maybe hoping for some summer baptisms when it'll be a little bit warmer, you know, not so freezing cold. That would be good. So do come and chat if you're interested, or if something last week made you think a little bit, then come and talk to myself and we take it from there. Jesus says, listen, I am standing at the door knocking. If you hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to you and eat with you and you with me. Jesus says, listen, I understand how you feel today, full of joy and excitement, or full of sorrow and sadness. And I stand at the door and I knock, and all you need do is open it and welcome me. And today we gather round Jesus' table on this day of mixed emotions, and we recognise his sacrifice for us, so that whether we feel joyous today or terribly sad today, Jesus can be so close to us. We recognise his sacrifice so that one day we can all be gathered together in him, know his forgiveness and his reconciliation. Oh, it's posh tea. Oh, yes. Enjoy your posh tea and your chocolates. If you don't drink tea or eat chocolate, I'm so very sorry, but enjoy someone else sitting drinking and eating. Anyway, it's time for the children. Did everyone get one? Yeah. Or something? Wonderful. It's time for the children and young people to go to their various groups, for us to settle into whatever spot we want to be in. Our reading this morning is from the book of Matthew, as we continue our series on Matthew. And it's chapter 9, verses 18 to 20. While he, that was Jesus, was saying this, a synagogue leader came and knelt before him and said, my daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live. Jesus got up and went with him, and so did his disciples. Just then a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, if I only touch his cloak, I will be healed. Jesus turned and saw her. Take heart, daughter, he said. Your faith has healed you. And the woman was healed from that moment. When Jesus entered the synagogue leader's house and saw the noisy crowd and the people playing pipes, he said, go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep. But they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. News of this spread through all of that region. Before I had children, if I went out and there was a family sitting near me with a child that looked a little bit ill, you know, snotty and pale and red eyes, I would be very polite and be like, oh, hello, that's lovely. But as soon as I could, I'd sort of, you know, edge away. We don't want to sit near the ill diseased, do we? And we go and enjoy somewhere else. Of course, now that I have children, and they're often snotty and red-eyed and, you know, ill, I don't back away. I don't go, oh, they're there. Just go in the other room, James. I cuddle them and I, you know, hold them and I get snot all over me and, you know, everywhere. And I change my clothes, you know, a couple of times a day. But I don't shy away because they're my children. And if they're your children and they're ill, however much you hate it, unless it's sick, Simon has to deal with that, however much you hate it, you go up to them and you cuddle them because they're not well and they need some help and some love and some comfort. And you know, this is fine, and I understand this, because they're our children, they're our problem if they're ill, and they want our love. But when things play out on a larger scale, when you have to have strangers who care for people, medical staff who are intervening in situations, and risk of infection and illness on a large scale, things become harder to manage. You can't just say, oh, well, people are ill, we'll give them a cuddle with fear of catching something. You have to put precautions in place. We have only have to look at the recent Ebola crisis in West Africa, don't we, to see the type of precautions that are put in place if you have infectious illnesses. Countries who used to cuddle each other and shake hands and were very tactile, we saw on the telly, then didn't touch each other because there was fear you might catch something. Communities and villages who were close together and looked after each other's families and children would put those who were thought to have Ebola on one side of the road and live on the other and watch them as they suffered and died, because there was this risk and this fear that infection would spread. And so precautions had to be put in place, even though they seemed harsh. The amount of sterilisation and equipment that had to be worn and still has to be worn for people who are treating patients is just immense, and the hours that it takes to get changed and to get dressed. But these protocols had to be put in place, slowly at first, but then rigorously, to help to prevent this disease from spreading. And it's the same with any contagious illness, whether it be life-threatening or not, whether it affects human beings or not. It has to have precautions. When we had the outbreak of foot and mouth disease in our country in 2001, I don't know whether you remember, but protocols and precautions were put across the country. You couldn't walk on public footpaths. A lot of them were closed. You had to walk through the disinfectant baths if you were going through farm areas, areas with cattle, and loads of cattle were disposed of. You saw their bodies burning along the sides of the roads when you were driving through the country. It cost many farmers their livelihood, but in the end it was essential to rid the country of this illness. And back in the times of Jesus, in first century Jewish culture, a culture that lacked the medical advances that we have today, protocols and procedures to keep the community free of infection were followed rigorously. If someone or something was seen to be contaminated, then they were shunned from the community. Now, it was not because people were unfeeling or uncaring. It was because there was a danger. There was a danger that this one infection, this one impurity, would spread throughout the whole community. And so it had to be stopped. And two of the most feared contaminants for the people in Jesus' time were those which we encounter in the Bible passage that I just read. Women who were impure because they were bleeding, and people who were dead bodies. And because these situations were so feared, to keep society clean, to keep society pure, if you like, women who were bleeding were pushed to the edges of society. If it was part of a menstrual cycle, they lived on the edge until they passed through that period, and then they could come back into society. But the woman in the passage, she'd been bleeding for 12 years. So in effect, she was an outcast. She wasn't allowed in at all. She lived on the edge of society. That was her home. And she was neither known by people or particularly cared for by them. The little girl, on the other hand, that we encounter in this passage, she was part of a well-respected Jewish family. So chances are she would have been well-known and well-loved within the community of the day. She lived at the centre of society. But now, of course, she had died. And so she too enters the realm of the unclean. Her body is impure, and therefore she too needs to be extracted from the community. But interestingly, in this story, those involved are not ready to be pushed to the edges of the community. Neither the woman who has been bleeding for 12 years, nor the family of the little girl who has died, want to be extracted from the Jewish community which they live in. Instead, they desire to have a life. They want to live. And so they come to Jesus because they've heard all about this preacher. They've heard all about this man who can heal, this person who can forgive, this one who can make all things well. And so they come to him to seek help. Two people from the opposite ends of society, a well-respected official, the father of the little girl who has died, a civil servant, if you were to maybe draw comparisons, someone who walked with a measured step and held their head tall in society, and a woman, one who hid in the shadows, one who probably walked with a stoop, hoping that no one would notice who she was. Two very different people who, when they find themselves in the state of impurity that they are deemed to be in, come to Jesus and throw themselves at his feet. They don't care about procedure to keep their respected distance from this teacher who is teaching his disciples, but they have enough faith to break with protocol and hope that he will make them well. And of course, this is exactly what Jesus does. Or if you like, knowing the impurity that he will be entering into, he gets up and goes with the man, and so do his disciples. They follow him. He doesn't pause to wash or send someone else first just to check whether she really is dead and it's a bad situation. He simply goes. He gets up and he went. And on the way, as if that's not enough, Jesus is touched by this woman who is bleeding. He's touched by someone whose impurity is feared throughout society. By the end of this passage, Jesus will be doubly unclean, if that's at all possible. It's a situation which would only be resolved by him washing his clothes and himself and going out of society for a day before coming back in the following day, just to make sure that he's still not doubly unclean. And yet, before he is forced to extract himself in this way, something amazing happens that renders the social protocols and procedures redundant. Because when Jesus is touched by the woman, when Jesus is touched by impurity and illness, and then takes the hand of the little girl, or takes the hand of death, if you like, Jesus doesn't become impure. He doesn't become doubly unclean. He doesn't become shunned or rejected like the people that he has reached out to. Instead, he transforms. Jesus transforms these situations. This lady, the lady who's been bleeding, the lady who for the past 12 years has lived untouched and unloved, suddenly finds she's restored. Not only is she not bleeding anymore, but her life is transformed. She is free to live. She can hug if she wants to. She can touch someone else. She can walk around the market with everyone else. And she can belong to society. Her life is totally changed because she's touched Jesus' cloak. And having transformed her life, Jesus then goes and takes the hand of the little girl who is dead. And we know she's dead because they've already started the mourning process. The crowd have gathered, the music is being played, the family are in mourning. And Jesus walks in, bold as you like, and he touches death. And instead of being drawn into this impurity, instead of being tainted and contaminated by this darkness, he transforms it into the very best that life can offer. The little girl gets up and lives again. There's not much that is better than that in our life. Because, you know, in some amazing way, when Jesus is touched by illness and death, when he encounters exclusion and segregation, when he comes into contact with the worst that life can offer, he doesn't become tainted or impure or a little bit less than he was. Instead, he transforms all these things into the best that life can give. Or if you like, when Jesus is invited into the situation of life, the darkness and the terribleness, instead of joining in with the protocols and the procedures that society puts in place, he renders them useless and he brings in a new way of living, his way, a way that is known as the kingdom of God. And it's a way that's here today too, in among all the darkness and the illness and the things that affect our lives. But it makes me think, you know, it makes me think, I wonder if there's anything in our lives that is like that of the man or the woman in the story. You know, I wonder if there is something in our lives that makes us feel impure. I wonder if there's something in our lives that causes us, like the woman in the story, to want to walk with our heads down. I wonder if there's something in our lives that we feel, if it were fully known by people, would put us on the edges of society. I wonder if we've ever felt like the woman who had forgotten what it was like to be truly loved and cared for. I wonder if we've ever felt like the man who had entered the hell of losing a child, someone so very precious. I wonder if we've ever looked around at society and labelled certain groups as useless or unclean. I wonder if we've ever looked at different lifestyles and thought them to be impure. I wonder if we've ever run from contamination and darkness, leaving others to walk alone in that nightmare. The likelihood is that one or more of these things has happened to us or is part of our lives. And maybe the bigger question is, where has Jesus fit into these situations that we find ourselves in? And where does Jesus fit in to the attitudes that we hold towards other people in our society? Because today's passage shows that he is well used to facing those things that marginalise and cripple us. And today's passage also shows that he's well used to facing the prejudices that render us useless to love other people because we've put them into some kind of box. And when he faces them, when he's invited into them, he is also well used to transforming them into situations that breathe life into the world around. So I guess the challenge for us maybe is, can we be like the woman and the man in this story? We may have situations similar to them, but can we be like them? People who were bound by the protocols and procedures of the day, but still had the faith to kneel before God in desperation, believing he could make a difference and transform their world. Because following God, as we know, is not about having it all sewn up. It's not about knowing it all and getting it all right. It's not about standing on principle and declaring right from wrong. It's not about being pure and shunning impurity. It's about realising that we have a God who cares. A God who cares more than any mother cares for her sick child. And more, we have a God who can do something about our situations. Not a God who is rendered useless because our society is sophisticated and organised. But a God who, when invited into life, can transform all that society is powerless to touch. Phone ringing. Maybe it's God. I believe in this kind of God who can transform our society, who can transform our lives. I don't always throw myself at his feet, and I don't always follow him as the disciples did into situations which I deem to be impure. But I do know that if life is going to be transformed, if my life and the life of those around me is going to be transformed, then I need to try to trust God more and I need to try to throw myself at his feet. We need to try. We need to come before God and we need to kneel at his feet with all our prejudices and impurities and contaminations so that then by his grace he can transform our lives into the best that they can be. Let's pray together. We're going to sing our final hymn together. And we're going to take up the offering as well during our final hymn. Let's stand and sing, "Crown Him with Many Crowns." Let's stand. So may we enjoy the rest of our day, whether we be cooked for or cooking, putting our feet up or not. May God walk with us and surround us, and may we know the power of his risen life. Please be seated.